This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And good morning to all you ZoomX, you Zoom folks out there in Zoom land. Today we're having a very nice morning with sunshine coming out after an evening of rain. Feels very refreshing here. I'd like to begin with, in this traditional way, with a case from the Shoyuroku, the Book of Serenity. This is case 57, and here's the introduction. Playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know that the voice is the root of the echo. If it is not riding an ox looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? And here's the case. Venerable Yangyan asked Zhaozhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhaozhou said, put it down. Yangyang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhaozhou said, then carry it out. In this time, this extraordinary time where we are experiencing a kind of different, an apparent different reality, a different context, and dimension for our respective lives and our sense of what society is. We have this, well, first of all, I'd like to say that in just going out slightly from the kind of womb of Jikoji up here, our little society that's been contained for some time, I've noticed that that we're actually doing very well as a culture, as a people, in responding to this this situation. I feel like we're as I've noticed people waiting in line to shop and being respectful of each other's distance. Of course, there's exceptions, and some exceptions even in the even in the highest places. I feel like basically we're all practicing this simple activity of when expecting these new circumstances. So in a sense, what I've experienced is, and the people here at Jikoji are handling this with great great respect as well. What I'm finding is that we're all becoming very simple and essential in a physical way together. We're all doing it. We're all doing it quite well. And I think that given that we're in this situation, this is an opportune time for us to continue the work of simplifying, of refining our way of discovering what's essential and elemental, not just physically, but also internally. Doug, last week, I was very impressed with what Doug said about this time, and that the practice itself can be understood as a kind of an experiment, that this is a laboratory for our investigation of reality, of how we are, what we are, and how we are in relation to all things. I've mentioned this before. I've always loved this story of the early Sangha, that the early Sangha, the monks and the nuns, left the householder life. They put the householder life behind them and chose to specialize in just doing this one thing, this practice of the way. And in so doing, they simplified their life. They refined their life, and they refined their life physically so that they, so essentially they could focus on refining their life internally as well. So the outward simplicity of their life, just having a robe and a bowl, mirrored their intention to simplify or essentialize, you could say, their internal life. It's even said that the monks and nuns who have practiced for a long time, when they brought their bowl to receive an offering, the monks and nuns at that time didn't work. They just did their practice and relied on the lay people to support them. And so they brought their empty bowls to the laity, and the laity gave them food. And it's said that the older monks who had practiced longer and settled down into the simplicity, their internal simplicity, they received more food because their bowls appeared to be more empty. They appeared to be free of or liberated from anything extra, and so the laity said, "Oh, I see. There's nothing there, and I want to support you. I see that you're completely empty, and I want you to keep living and keep practicing." So these older monks and nuns got more food than the monks that had, or nuns that had just started out. And so they shared with those that were new. It's a nice story. Question for us now is, now that we have that it's been imposed upon us, or that it's the condition of this current life, is now that we have a simpler life, when we have to shelter in place, or we have to be alone, or have to be have to contain or the some degree, can we use this opportunity to also refine or simplify our internal life? And can we do that, and how can we do that? So that's what I'd like to address today. How can we use this, I would say, vital opportunity to simplify our internal life? It is understood that, particularly in our tradition, that the meditation practice itself is a effort to simplify our internal life. And actually, the physical activity of sitting still and sitting quietly in itself is an expression of our internal life. And even in our particular meditation tradition of facing the wall is an expression of our willingness to simplify. We're actually deliberately setting up a situation where our sense field is somewhat contained by just facing the wall. And we attempt to just be with our body and just to be with our minds, just as they are. Facing the wall is like stopping. Basically, obviously, if you're walking down the road and you come to a wall, the normal thing that you would do is stop. Otherwise, you'd bump your nose and hit the wall, right? And that wouldn't be that would be another interesting practice, but. Meeting the wall means to stop. Or if stop sounds like too strong a word, we could say it's the willingness to pause. We stop physically, and we stop internally. We stop mentally as well. So in our meditation, we have the experience of recognizing our state of mind, recognizing consciousness itself. And oftentimes, commonly, when we begin to meditate, we recognize the fullness and the creativity and the abundance of our mental energy, our mental production. And that's our experience often in meditation. We meet the mind that's still in motion and still talking. And what to do? Well, we sometimes say, just do one thing. Just try placing your mind on one thing. Try enjoying each breath as it comes up and it releases. Receiving and releasing with inhalation and exhalation. Just try doing that one thing and see if you can settle the abundance of your mind and let it be simple. Let it be elemental. Let it be at rest for a time. I remember hearing a story of a person that went to see a Tibetan teacher, and he said, my mind is wild. My mind is so busy. My mind is so active. Teacher, what should I do to settle my mind?" And the teacher said, "You have thoughts in your mind, and the student said, "Yes, I have many thoughts." "Do you have different thoughts? Do you have one thought after another?" And the student said, "Yes, I do. I have one thought after another." "Are you able to notice that there's that one thought ends and another thought begins?" And the student said, "Yes, I do. I notice that one thought begins and one thought ends." The teacher said, "There's a gap between those thoughts. Your practice is simply to enlarge that gap. That's all. Don't stop thinking. Don't constrain your thoughts. Just notice and enjoy the gap between those thoughts. And if you can, enlarge them." That's a nice teaching. I appreciated hearing that. I'm still working on that one. So we're in this circumstance of this opportune time to simplify our lives. Both they have been simplified physically. We can grab this opportunity to simplify, to refine our internal life and make it simple as well. Like Rilke said, this perfect innocence before anything can begin, a perfect innocence must be achieved. And that is, that beginning place is where true arrival, where true creativity begins. So how do we work on this internal simplification? One thing I've been studying a little bit myself is a trying to understand the tendency, the habitual tendency to hold, to have and hold views, to have fixed views, to have fixed patterns of mental production, and to become habituated in having a view. And we think that it's impossible to not have views. And in one aspect, that's true. We need to have certain ideas or preconceptions or models of the world in order to negotiate the world. And need to become available, you could say, to our experiences sometimes by bringing to them a model or a preconception of what they are or what it is. This tendency is sometimes called patternicity. So there's these two aspects to a lot of cognitive biases and a lot of preconceptions. And these two tendencies are called that we commonly put upon the world and put upon our relationships and put upon our mental formations of the world. And these two are called patternicity and agenticity. So these are tendencies that we have. One is the patternicity is simply to ascribe meaning or ascribe to any pattern or that we have. In other words, like the illustration that's used in my reading is that you hear the rustle of a wind. You're in the savannah. And maybe you're a hunter, and you hear the rustle of the wind, and you the pattern of that, of hearing that sound, comes with the assumption that it may be a lion approaching you, ready to attack you. That's called type one patternicity. And type two patternicity is you make another assumption that, oh, it's just the wind, but it actually is the lion. So this patternicity is an overlay that we put on top of the world, on top of our experience, assuming that this native experience that we're having, this initial primary experience that we're having, has to conform to a certain pattern. It's recognized by being in confirmation to a pattern. So the question is, can we release ourselves from our tendency to bring to the world a model or bring to the world a preconception or like the Metta Sutra said, can we release ourselves from a fixed idea of bringing to the world a pattern, an assumption, a view, a preconception, a prejudice, a bias? Can we bring to the world, can we actually release or relax that patterning tendency, that assumption that we make, and see the world as it is before it has the overlay of our ideas of what it is, to see it as it is? The other habitual tendency that we have is called agenicity. And agenicity is an assumption or the implied projection upon reality that things have a meaning, or that because something happened, it happened because of one thing or another. It has a implicit and inherent cause. There's a term called top-down agenicity, which implies another power. So because something exists, it implies a agency, an outside agency that caused this thing to happen. In other words, like theists that believe in an outside agency of a deity assume that the cause or the agency of our existence, of all existence, comes from the outside. But there's other people that believe in or assume what's called essentialism. And essentialism implicitly assumes that there's an essence to everything. There's an implied essence to everything. And because there's an essence to everything, there's agency in our life because of that essence, because that particular essence. It implies a kind of locus of control that is basically just inferred. So these two terms, these two aspects, patternicity and agenticity, are something I've been looking at, as well as these vast array of cognitive biases. And wondering and if we can in our practice life basically release ourselves from these and see what's left, see what remains, without assuming implicit patternicity or agenicity to our life, to let go of views, of these fixed views. Then we ask, what remains? What's left? to make a place, to make an opportunity to see what remains, to see if we ourselves are an available vehicle or an entry place for reality, for things as they are to come forward. The proposition is that we need to make room for them, for this gate to be open, where we can see things as they are, where we can experience things as they are. We need to make room. We need to make space for them to come forward. And in order for there to be space, the abundant filling of our internal life needs to be released or relaxed. And that is essentially what we're doing or attempting to do in meditation, is to sit down and be still for a while, to sit down and be quiet for a while, be quiet on the outside and be quiet on the inside, and see what happens, see what's left, see what's there. I'm not sure about the time. Does anyone know how we're doing?
It's a quarter after 12.
So I think we have some time for discussion. There's a message.
Can maybe Nico or Ben prompt who is asking a question? It'd probably be easier for them to see than for you, Mike. Yeah, do you want to let them?
There's a message here. Oh, Ben just appeared. So yeah. I think it's working. Hi, Ben.
Do we have audio on here?
I used to always tell people.
Something's happening.
Might have the audio we turned down on this.
Okay.
Let me check.
All right. See you every day. You too. All right, dear, I am done.
If I punch something in on the chat, can they trace it?
Please.
Michael's going on about overcoming biases, like, you know, and it's just, you're going to sit and be quiet.
I'll just say something practical. If you're not speaking, you should mute yourself, because I don't know if the rest of you can hear that background noise from somebody else. But it can get rather unwieldy if you've got that going on.
So are there any questions? Can you, is anybody, Nico or Ben, whoever's hosting?
Yeah.
Are there any questions for Mike or comments?
I encourage people to raise their hands or guess.
Okay.
Michael. Oh. Hold on one second.
Oh, wait. Listen to my ears.
I'm unmuted.
Yeah, I'll speak. Question. You unmuted me? Okay, thank you. I've got a very interesting topic. I would imagine the ageism, someone coming to sit at Jokoji who's 20, and myself coming to Jokoji to sit at 66, will have really different viewpoints. Different biases that you bring, you know, and I don't know, my first thought that comes to mind, if we have the biases, then we can't let new things in, you know, we can't let new ideas. I mean, I'm sure there's all kinds of things that we can bring in, but if, we have to be able to see them. And what the 20 year old sees and what the 66 year old sees are really different. Like, it shouldn't be different, but you can't help it.
Well, if they come to Jokoji to sit, maybe they're willing to take a look.
Commonly, the views that people, when they first come to sit, is they have a view of what Buddhism is, or what Zen is, or what meditation is, that's not necessarily based on personal experience, but on something they've read or something they've heard, and sometimes the what you might call the sales gimmick of enlightenment, or the idea of a profound experience, or a kind of a changed state, becomes a kind of fixed view, or an attitude that they bring to meditation and to the meditation experience, and find that it's actually hard work. It's actually like digging. It's like digging in the dirt and actually deep digging and finding things that you don't necessarily sometimes you don't necessarily like have been buried in the graveyard of your consciousness. So dealing with those and meeting with those, of course, takes some courage. So oftentimes people in the beginning retract from that, but if they can stay with it and meet yourself at those crossroads, be there, then you might find that the practice wakes up for you. There's a bias called, there's a number of these cognitive biases. Confirmation bias is the common one. There's another bias called hindsight bias, where we reconstruct the past to fit present knowledge or belief. There's various attribution biases. There's a number of different biases as they've come down. But to just see our minds when we practice is see these things arising and to make a little space is the important work of practice. Yeah, Hogan.
Yeah, you saying make a little space reminds me of, I want to take us back to earlier in your talk, you spoke of a teaching where the teacher was encouraging the students to notice the space between the thoughts, and said to the student, your job is to make those gaps larger. Hmm. Or perhaps another way to put it is, dwell there, dwell contentedly there. And it reminds me, that seems like a very good example of the kind of thing that one cannot do. And what I mean by that is I once listened to a teacher who was talking about his own spiritual development, and a big cusp in his development was he had been he'd been screwed down so tight and working so hard endlessly to achieve this enlightenment. And he knew that he was tenacious and tireless, and he was just going to keep trying. And then finally he came, one of his big breakthroughs was he just realized, oh my God, I can't do this.
Hmm.
Enlightenment is nothing you do.
Hmm.
In fact, it's sort of something, it's coming to a place where you can dwell in
non-doing.
Exactly.
In non-doing.
Yeah. So this is where I wanted to start. So tell me more about the not doing.
It reminds me a story of the Buddha, or the way his initial experience is described in accord with what you're talking about. At the time of the Buddha, they believed in this, very importantly, in this agenicity of that, and an essentialism of life, so that they understood in the Vedic tradition, in the Upanishads and so on, that there's an essence within everyone. There's an essence, a soul, basically. What we would, in the West, we would call it a soul. A unifying aspect of each consciousness that's unified with Brahma, with the universal soul.
Mm-hmm.
Basically a self, a kind of eternal self. And when the Buddha first began to meditate, when he first, he investigated this, he looked for a self. He studied this, and he went into meditative states to study this. And, he looked for a self, and he couldn't find one. He found the five skandhas. He found that there was substantiality, there was form, there was sensation or feelings, there was perceptions, that's part of the experience of perceptions, and there's mental formations, and there's consciousness itself. He found that, but he didn't find a essence, a self. And it said that it's described this way that the Buddha woke up by failing to find a self. In other words, his enlightenment, or part of his enlightenment, was the recognition of no self, of anatman, it's called. This is a kind of non-doing, a non-being. And part of our part of the teachings that come to us, and part of our understanding of the Buddha way, is this what would you might call it, a failure, or you might call it a recognition of what's essential, or what's elemental or simple, that that there's not a established essence. There's just this, and then let's be with just this. Let's. Does that help?
Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else?
Well, what that brought up, right as you were finishing, it brought up to me a suspicion I have regarding when I hear or I read or hear something that is urging me to find the mystery, to explore the mystery, that seems, I'm suspicious of that, that seems to be taking me away from just this. And it sounds like, in a sense, what you were describing in the Buddha's path was he was looking for the mystery, the essential self, for the, you know, the causation thing, rather than just landing in the moment and not being distracted by, there's something here I can't see, there's something here that it you know, that's beyond my regular awareness.
Instead of saying, it's all here.
It's all here.
Yeah, everything's here.
Yeah.
In fact, everything's available. Not only is everything here, but everything's available.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and I guess it's also important to not be fixed in that, because a moment ago it was clear to me what all was available and what was all here, it might be the case that in the next moment there might be something I can't explain at all based on the previous moments that I've experienced. And that's okay too. But to not sit and hold my breath waiting for this mysterious magical thing to appear. It'll appear if it needs to. But just focus on.
We have to acknowledge too that we're attracted to, and we're even seduced by the assumptions of what's out there, what's other, what's magical, or the assumption of a implicit essence. We're attracted to that. So we have all kinds of systems, you could say, you know, various models of describing the world in symbolic ways that attempt to assume some kind of outside agency or some implicit agenicity that's outside of ourselves. Yeah, we're attracted to that, and so if you look at human history, not just religious history, but cultural histories, it's imbued with that. I mean, all kinds of rites and rituals and formulas, and right now, I mean, even these old systems of astrology and the rites, religious rites, and even the Buddhist, some of the Buddhist rituals could be included in that. We're we're attracted to that agenicity, mm-hmm. Implying agenicity to the world. Yeah.
We should finish up for now, but we invite more questions through the website, and please donate to us through the website as well.
And thank you.
I see that you have the Donna Bowl there.
Well, should I hold this up? Donna Bowl. I guess we're done.
Yeah.
This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.